the mission of this program, which is to read critically, but not entirely biasedly, meaning like we're going to be sympathetic when we can. We're going to be critical when we're supposed to be. We're not going to compromise our own values here, but versions of reading conservative, reactionary, and traditionalist political thought. Think something like Know Your Enemy, but with a broader mandate and not just interested in whatever the most popular trend is in the GOP right now. And we decided to start with Dugin, and we did a whole show explore it with Jason and I explored this, but we decided to start with Dugin's fourth political theory because Dugin is a oft-quoted, oft-even-used, patriotic socialists use him, political theorist who is not that important in Russia. We just talked about this in episode 02, but he might be more important elsewhere. And who is often portrayed as simply an irrationalist, and I do think there's irrationalist elements to his books, but that he's not stupid. Despite going on Alex Jones, despite sounding like a weird Russian Orthodox crank, he is not stupid. He might be a coffee shop fascist, but he's a smart, or let me rephrase that. He's not a fascist. He is a post-fascist of some sort. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to like deal with what that means. But who I think is, who in some ways, from the standpoint of when he wrote this book in Russia in 2009 and when it got published in America two times, once kind of in an underground form, just published by Mark Shabobda, see episode zero where I talk about who that guy is, and then Mark Shabobda and Mark Millerman, the American academic, clean this up and publish this with Arctos Press. Arctos Press is a very strange press. It's a press run by an American and a Swedish post former neo-Nazi out of India that publishes all kinds of European new right, alt-right, and post-fascist material.
Yeah.
But has had influence recently on the American left through patriotic socialism and stuff close to it. And
who is this? What's their name?
Arctos Press. Arctos. That's the people who publish the readily available version. There is another translation available, actually, that was put out by Dugin's own organization for political theory that came out the same year. That was just by Mark Shabobda. I think I sent it to at least one of you. It does not read as clearly as this. Millerman did a good job of like cleaning this up, probably closer to the Russian. Although Shabobda worked on this translation with Millerman, so
you know you've made it, like similar to Marx and Engels have made it when people start debating and splitting over the various different translations of your text. So obviously, yeah. Dugin's an important guy because you've got various different translations.
Well, and he's an important guy that. Again, see episode zero, we go into this in detail. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this. That when liberals decided to turn him into a boogeyman in 2016 and 2017, it actually led people to profoundly misunderstand him, both in his power and what he actually believed.
Like, so he's not some Svengali for Putin.
Right? Absolutely, I mean, not.
This is what we've gotten from the MSNBC world.
Right. He's not. I mean, he was arguably more influential in Russia directly between 2011 and 2014. And one of the things that confuses us is I think Eurasianism and multipolarity is popular in Russia, but Dugin's not the only place that comes from.
Right.
But let's get into this. We're going to talk about the introduction. We're going to try to get through chapter one today. And we're going to try to do one to two chapters at a time. And we might try to get through chapter two, that was on our agenda. However, I realized in rereading chapter two that it gets into the whole things about Heidegger. And that one might take more exposition than we might have time for today because I got to go check my being in time again.
Have you guys read Heidegger before? I'm a virgin. You have. Okay.
I am very, very vaguely familiar, but like honestly, before chapter two, if we don't get to chapter two, I'd be fine with that because I also will go back and brush up a lot on my Heidegger.
There's a Richard Stolen takedown at Heidegger that I think people should read.
Actually. I still got my fucking overalls on, guys. I just got home from work. I don't know if I had much Heidegger in me. Ever Being in Nothingness might be one of the more difficult texts ever to read, right?
Being in time.
Sartre. Being
in Time. Yeah. Well, I would actually say yes. I have read Being in Time like 5 times, and I don't know that I understand it.
Worse than Marx again.
Way, way worse than Marx. All right. So, let's talk about the introduction. And I'm going to people who know my methodology, I kind of don't love when people go through books on podcasts but don't actually read any of the book and they just assert what their interpretation of it is. And while I'm okay with that, I sort of think like we should actually talk about what the text says. So there's going to be lots of me quoting the text.
Going just off of like a very brief kind of summary of the whole chapter, my position is distinct from line by line reading. And I'm aware of that even as I'm going through the book. So line by line reading is very valuable to make sure that I actually have a full picture of everything.
Yeah. So
can I say too, before we start, that it's nice to be podcasting with Jason because I am a listener of Regrettable Century. So yeah. Thanks for all that you guys have done.
Yes. Thank you.
The Podiverse contracts even more. a former reactionary, a former trot, and a former communizationist, whatever that was,
Isn't
it communizer?
Yeah, communizer.
It's communizer, but with the E-U-R at the end. So it's like communizer. Well,
it makes it more sophisticated that way.
It's so sophisticated. You wouldn't even know how sophisticated it is.
Yeah.
You'd have to read it in the original French.
Come together to talk about fourth political theory. You know, it's going to be interesting. I bring that up because one of the things that if people listen to our episode zero that people just will learn about me, I know a lot more about right-wing politics than I even let on. So, like,
a lot more than I do.
Not all of us were in it, you know. Right. You were in it.
And I've been on to Dugin for a long time. My first encounter with Dugin, which I think was even before this book was published, but it's from a book called Against the Modern World: Traditionalism and the Secret History of the 20th Century, which came out in 2004. And then another book that's not about Dugin, but it's about the precursor to Duginism, which is about Yaquiism, are the weird American national fascist, national Bolshevik hybrid movement that was led by Francis Parker Yaqui, called Dreamer of the Day by Kevin Coogan. And I saw the shifts in Dugin's thinking kind of in real time, because he was associated with Limonov National Bolshevik Party and explicitly with kinds of fascist and post-fascist thought in the 90s, which he starts to abandon in the early aughts. And so that's going to be interesting. Keep that in mind. The other thing about Duginites, I think we should read this. You will meet sometimes Marxist-Leninists who are also like multipolaristas who are not so secretly Duginist. Right. Who will say Dugin is an anti-fascist. And one of the things I'm going to say is like, in the same way that like Baudrillard's an anti-Marxist. Sort of true in that Dugin does have a critique of fascism in both its statist and racialist ideologies, But also, like, he explicitly comes out of a fascist world, was fascist, and will occasionally endorse fascist people explicitly in a limited context. So right. You have to be careful with that. But all that said, you know, if you want to understand an enemy that can both play the clown and be smart, Dugin's very interesting, because reading this book, you realize that, like, this book can appeal to someone who's been educated in leftist post-Marxist theory very easily. And as I was saying off air, it takes Agamben and turns it against you. It takes Heidegger. Well, Heidegger was never on your side anyway, if you're a leftist, but a lot of leftists thought he was, and turns it against you. It takes Foucault and turns it against you. It takes Derrida and turns it against you in ways that are hard to argue from that point of view. And he casts some critiques of Marxism that are hard for Marxists to answer in a very real way.
As we get into chapter one, you can see the reason why this is a thinker that people seem to be forced to grapple with, because as we'll talk about, he's identifying something, a global phenomenon, sociological, intellectual phenomenon, which is, of course, what we would call the end of history, right? He's talking about this transition from the condition of modernity to the condition of postmodernity, and it's a deeply historical argument that he's making, right? He's trying to wipe away, clean the slate of the 20th century and argue that there is something that is superseding that. And once you're on that terrain where you're not talking about, you know, ideal forms, you're not going back to Plato and Aristotle, you're not talking about ever-present, everlasting moral or political truths, that instead you're historicizing, all of us with a particular Marxist ear to listen all of a sudden perk up, because right. He's making, at the end of the day, a historical, historicizing argument.
Yeah, we'll get to where he breaks that. Even in the first chapter, but I think you're absolutely correct, and I think, you know, there's a lot of obvious influences are going to be cited, then there's non-obvious ones which are actually super popular but people aren't going to immediately see. I definitely think this book has, you know, that when Dugin's writing this book, he's also responding to Atlanticists in Russia who are familiar with, like, Alan Bloom, the Closing of the American Mind, the Class of Civilizations books. What's that guy?
Samuel Huntington.
Samuel Huntington. There's definitely Francis Fukuyama's all over this book.
Yeah.
And Fareed Zakaria, weirdly, is all over this book. If you remember in 2007, at the end of the Bush administration, Fareed Zakaria, of all people, was talking about how America in liberalism had to adjust to a multipolar world before anyone in communist land was using that terminology.
Right.
And that's all in the background here. So he's definitely... He is... One of the things we have to remind ourselves is he's trying to fend off the popularity of the ideas coming out of the new American century, because this book does come out of 2009. But one of the things that if you think about that, and it was translated in 2012, if you think about that, then it makes this book more disturbing, because in some ways it gets some things right that books from the exact same time period don't. And that should worry us. And I don't say this like, because, like, I want to point out where I think there's being stuff being snuck in and stuff that I don't think holds water. But let me just read some of this introduction. Liberalism, which has always insisted on de-emphasizing the importance of politics, and we'll get to why it has to do that in a minute, that's in the first chapter, made the decision to abolish politics completely after its triumph. Now, aside from the whole reification fallacy in that, liberalism deciding to do something, there's a truth to that. Mm. Like,
we're going to...
There's a basic truth to that, yeah.
We're going to continue to see this fallacy over and over again, because one of the things that I saw in chapter one and two is things emerge, but there's no real actor behind them, right? Things are constantly emerging. Things are constantly happening, but there's no agency and there's no sort of developmental process, which for any of us who are like steeped in Marxism, you're already like, huh? All right, why are these things occurring? Why are they happening?
But those of us who are steeped in Marxism do that, but we have to think about like the popularity in the aughts and kind of still the popularity of stuff like epistemes coming out of Foucault are enclosed modes of existence coming out of Althusserian Marxist. If you're of those kinds of orientations, you also don't deal with the precise relations of production that actually make these things emerge. In fact, you bracket that out as unscientific, weirdly. And so if you're of that orientation, I actually don't know how you argue with Dugin. Because those people also have stuff that seems to just emerge somehow and be totalized like that.
I think that those people just don't argue with Dugin because they would just say, oh, he's a fascist and fascists are racist. And so I already know Dugin, he's a racist. I don't need to know anything else. And that's it.
Yeah, there's Hitler particles coming off all over him, right? There's like this sort of... since the Second World War, right, this sort of like founding mythos of the sort of liberal century of like the end of history, really, you have this sense that like fascism is always lurking in the background. It's like this idea, this like idea that's out there. And if you even engage with it, it all of a sudden will come back and bite you.
But then there's also this tendency in Marxism to say, well, fascism is purely liberal in the first place. It's just liberalism in crisis, which I think is actually not true.
It's also not helpful.
Yeah.
It's not like a good shorthand. It'd be one thing if that led you to doing something that was helpful, but it's just, it's lazy and it's also not helpful at all.
Right.
It leads you to anti-fascism, which, as we've seen very vividly over the last 10 years, is a cul-de-sac.
It was just anti-fascism is just to give urgency to popular frontism. That's all it does.
That's right.
And we can see that it's also very superficial because they didn't really care how many of the they being the broad anti-fascist coalition, you know, the individual anti-fa groups maybe still do. I'm not saying they don't. But the broad Democratic Party anti-fascist coalition did not say anything when most of the Trumpist policies that were unique to Trump were maintained by Biden. They tried to at first distance, claim that there was more distance between the policies than there were. And when that became undeniable, they just shut up about it entirely. Yeah.
Well, right. Because the concern about fascism is about fascists, like, if Trump is there, then it's fascism. And if he's not there, then it's not really. It's kind of like how China is communist, regardless of what they do, because of the fact that they are individually communists.
But the point of all of this is the resistance. The point is to wed everybody back into the popular front and to scare people for good and bad reasons. There's very good reasons to be scared.
I want to get back into this beginning.
I was going to say, I wonder if Sean knows he's lost, but I think he knows now.
Yeah. Let's talk about this for a second. Regardless of the rationale, liberalism did everything possible to ensure the collapse of politics. And I think this is true, although the regardless of the rationale is kind of doing what Sean was accusing it of doing, is like hiding how we got here.
Right.
At the same time, liberalism itself has changed, passing from the liberal of ideas, political programs and declarations to the level of reality, penetrating the very flesh of the social fabric, which has become suffused with liberalism and in turn has begun to seem like the natural order of things. And I think this is true.
Yeah, that's entirely.
Like liberal assumptions are naturalized to the point that I have trouble for people understanding me when I critique them. Mm. Like when I talk about like, hey, you can't talk about like, technological progress as if it's a unilateral totality moving in one direction. Like, that's a liberal assumption, and you can't, like, even Marxists and people who should theoretically know better, like, they're like, I might have issues with Marxist teleology, but Marxist teleology is not that linear, right? Because of things like analytical Marxism and whatnot, most people still somehow think that they can believe that and be a Marxist, right?
Yeah, like, on the Regrettable Century, when we talk about like the liberalism of the left, this is what we really mean. It's not like they are individually, like they have a philosophy of liberalism. It's that they're not even aware of the fact that their philosophy takes liberalism as its starting point.
Right. And so, like, when they read Marx and become Marxists, they still are interpreting the words with liberal assumptions even more than Marx did.
Yeah, it's not even a problem of interpretation. It's a problem of like social activity. Because what social activity is there besides glomming on to the left wing of the possible within capitalist bourgeois society in the 21st century?
Well, right? I think this is going to become a sticky wicket, and Dugan's a good place for us to kind of process a sticky wicket, is how much of this is because of the social reinforcement and how much of this is because of the hermeneutic loop. And I'll talk about what I mean by that. So some of this is like, we have to interpret things with the loop of which we're given, but why would we pick up that hermeneutic loop? Well, because it's socially useful, because that's what we're doing. That's how we think we do politics. That's how we think we do social life.
Yeah.
So we didn't have to, like, we're encouraged to limit ourselves to the hermeneutics that emerge from that. And then we interpret Marx through those hermeneutics. Now, this is not to say there's no liberal assumptions in Marx, and Dugan actually has one of the better understandings of Marxist relationship to liberalism than a lot of Marxists do.
It's okay, you can say it.
and that's just, well, because Dugan gets that both the Marxism is just anti-liberalism and that Marxism is just liberalism, they are both wrong. That Marxism is a development out of liberalism, but it is not liberalism. It becomes something else. And that, because of that, it's actually one of the things that he says that I believe that makes communists uncomfortable. And they're like, well, you know, fascism is just liberalism in crisis, or fascism is just corporatism, although a lot of that's from liberals who don't realize that corporatism there means something different than ruled by corporations. Mm. But
by that definition, the New Deal is fascist, right?
Right. Well, actually, by the actual definition of corporatism, the New Deal is also fascist. Right.
Fascist either way you cut it, yeah.
But one of the things that I want to point out is it's like, well, Dugan also gets that there's a weird relationship between fascism and communism that doesn't get communism totally off the hook.
Right.
For the emergence of fascism. Like, fascism is not communism. It's not even post-communism, but there's ways of thinking which communism made possible coming out of Marx that made fascism possible as a liberal response that, again, separates itself out of liberalism, becomes something else. And I don't see these kinds of conceptual frameworks worked out in this way. I mean, one of the things you can critique him for is he's not really discussing the precise relationships and mechanisms that made this possible, the actual deep history of this. And that is a fair critique, but I think, like, as a conceptual framework, that's a lot more advanced than a lot of what we see on the left right now, which is Marxism is liberalism. Nuh-uh, Marxism is anti-liberalism, which is, I mean, both of those arguments to me are just a waste of fucking time.
Like, I mean, you would have to go back like a century to find left wing writing, which is this specific and also dealing with the way that, I don't know, ideology even happens. So, right. Like, yeah, I mean, it is a valuable read despite the many criticisms.
Right.
Well, you know, we can read it as a positive program on the part of Dugan, which we will not do. We refuse to do. But we could also read it as a, like, a full frontal critique of Marxism and liberalism and fascism to the extent too. But I think that the most valuable thing for us to do, of course, is to understand it as like, is to read it as a self-critique of ourselves. Right. Right. Just to say, like, how is it that some Russian philosopher, some university, some post-Soviet guy has managed to do better with his analysis and his
some critique? Post-Soviet coffee house reactionary.
That's what I'm saying.
A guy who became a professor.
Right. Who flew a flag with Limonov and fucking pretended to shoot a 50 caliber rifle one time. How is he doing a better job of understanding ideas and social processes, perhaps, than many of our contemporaries, say, online or on Twitter?
Right. Yeah. And I think this is why, even though there's a, like I said earlier, there's a whole lot of overstatement of his influence. There is, both in Russia and to some degree abroad. And he's definitely not fucking Putin's Rasputin or whatever. But that is also sometimes conversely used to make it impossible to engage with him, because there is a shock. Like, the first time I read this text, and I guess it was shortly after it came out in 2013 is when I got a hold of it. I remember being shocked with, like, agreeing with parts of it, but then also thinking parts of it were batshit insane. And some of the stuff that I thought was batshit insane then, I don't think is insane now. And then there's other stuff that I didn't pick up as dog whistles that I now see. We'll get into that.
I'm about to fucking go off right now because I'm getting worked up right now. But like Dugin, given his life experience, given his interests, given his philosophy, understands something happened in 1991, right? Because he lived through it. I feel like I'm taking fucking crazy pills sometime when I'm seeing the rhetoric and the program of people online who want to imagine that 1991 didn't even fucking happen. Because I feel as though there's so much recycling of like mid-20th century, frankly, Stalinist positions on national liberation, on even the basis and existence of the Soviet Union in the 20th century, that is like we didn't learn fucking anything in the last 30 years. And Dugin's actually like been through this and understands the failure of the Soviet Union in ways that people online or in various different groups who celebrate, say, like the Afghanistan war in the 1980s with the Soviet Union are afraid to even comprehend.
I don't think we have learned anything, because I come from at this point it's pretty far back, but I at one point I hailed from a section of the left that saw the end of the USSR as like a positive development for socialism. So,
which is to me insane. But
yeah, I mean, for me too, it's actually entirely insane. But like, in either case, we didn't learn anything. We either thought it was great or basically that it didn't happen. Right. And in both cases, that's not true.
It happened and it was not good.
Right.
To go off though, to a little bit like, to go into Marx's great political treatise, the Brumaire, people LARPing when things are stalled is actually part of a revolutionary process. This is not making me hopeful for revolution. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is like, we should not be surprised that people are LARPing the mid-20th century, because that's the last time they felt like there was action. Mm-hmm. But right now, what we see in this action and this LARPing, and it's not just on the left, guys. Like, this is the other thing I'm going to point out. Like, there's a lot of LARPing on the right now.
Yeah, Bronze Age, Pervert, Cabana Boy, all these people, yeah.
Right. It's like people who want to go, you know, even when you look at, like, the, like, social conservative normie right, not even, like, Bronze Age Pervert kind of people, and normal social Democrats, you know what they want? Normal social Democrats say they want the New Deal, but what they actually argue for is the 1950s, is early Fordism. Mm-hmm. And you know what the fucking right wants? They want the social cohesion, without any of the other stuff, of early Fordism. And both of those are still LARPing. So my contention today is like, Yeah, of course Celeste is LARPing, because almost everybody is. And to not LARP almost requires you to be a fucking crazy weirdo.
Which is the point of Dugan's first chapter, which is that politics is over. Politics is dead. Politics, we all have this hangover from the 20th century, right? But we're all trying to LARP. We're all trying to relive various different of these three political tendencies that existed at the time when the social basis for it is gone.
Right. Well, I mean,
He's not arguing social basis. He's arguing something else. But
yeah, he's arguing something. Well, he argues like basically
you could fill that in though.
A being basis of social basis, which is interesting. But let me get into this section in the introduction.